each up here represented by council. It's a rule of the court that if you're represented by council, that you can't send to council.
Very much.
She's pro se, that's why she gets the court.
Oh, okay, very much.
I'm sorry.
No.
Your council also?
Yes, Your Honor, council.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
A lot going on. All right. Thank you, sir, for stepping back. You're Mrs. Steiner?
Yes, sir.
Very good. And you're Mr. Williams?
Yes, Your Honor.
Very good. I'm straight. All right, so you may begin when ready. Would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes. My name is Anthony Williams. I represent Mr. Garrett. Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to address the imputation of income for the spousal and child support analysis and how not only was that an abuse of discretion, but I think as a matter of law it was wrong because there were no facts on the record that supported Mr. Garrett was voluntarily underemployed or unemployed. The facts set forth that he was a government contractor on a one-year contract. That contract expired at 31 May.
Your argument seems to suggest, counsel, that the imputation of income in the context of what we used to call back in the day income averaging was not appropriate, et cetera.
Correct, Your Honor.
Let me ask you this, sir. If we don't, for a person that has the type of jobs or job that your client had, and there is no steadier baseline for determining income because of the changeover in contract and the like, how is it that a trial court is supposed to determine what would be a fair or equitable amount of income to attribute to your client?
By allowing evidence on why he was or was not employed. The fact that he was, while the contract expired and he was not picked up, he was in the psych ward at the VA hospital, I think, was set forth on the record, and that is key. The fact that he has had two such occasions of a 10-day stay within the past year is some of the evidence that made it onto the record.
So would his income be zero?
No, Your Honor. He had almost $24,800-some-odd from VA disability and almost $400 of retirement income. And I think by law, by statute, the court was to do the guidelines based on current income, that is, income that he actually had, and then if it were to deviate, make findings of fact as to that deviation. Voluntary underemployment or unemployment is one of those factors listed in 20-107.1.
And I appreciate what you say about the client and his disability, but doesn't the trial court enjoy a degree of discretion in determining the factual underpinnings as to what a fair amount of income would be? Doesn't the statutory scheme give the trial court wide discretion in listening to all the circumstances presented and making that determination?
Well, and that kind of leads into one of the other assignments of error, that is the refusal to allow the opening of evidence. My client was not present at a trial. I asked for a continuance. I then later asked for, I did a motion to reopen the evidence. There was a hearing. And strangely enough, while the judge did take some evidence on the issue of where he was on June 7th, etc., the trial court directed me after appellee's counsel stated that my client had a new source of income that he was employed. Trial court directed me to ask him, turn to my client and ask him, are you employed? Which I did. He said, no, he was still not employed at that time. And that was also evidence in the record that he was not employed. The moving party who is trying to impute income to somebody has the burden to establish that the lack of employment is voluntary.
At the trial level, as I recall, correct me if I'm wrong on the facts, when the case was on the date the case was set to be heard, you were present.
Correct.
All right, and counsel for the wife was present.
Yes, sir.
And there was some issue as to where your client was. You tried to find him, I think it's way out of your record.
Correct, Your Honor.
Now, the case has been set for trial by agreement, correct?
I think it was on term day, but more or less the paving issue.
Okay, and so then we get into the determination as to whether in the context of the continuance, we would have to find that the trial court abused its discretion by not granting continuance, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
That's a pretty tough standard.
Yes, Your Honor, but looking at the facts of the case, the day before, okay, this is roughly a week after he was released from the psych ward at the VA hospital in Richmond. The day after a protective order hearing, while he was in the Richmond hospital, his wife retrieved the phone that he was using from his car, found some information on there in which she filed for a protective order. Was granted emergency protective order while he was in the hospital. We had the protective order hearing 2 weeks thereafter, which was on June 6th, the Monday, in which the protective order was granted, allowing no contact between Mr. Garrett and his wife or kids. And this had a devastating impact on him. He took a pill, which he made mistakenly took the wrong pill, got in his car, felt woozy, and this is on record in the motion to reopen the evidence, did the right thing, pulled off somewhere, spaced out, blacked out, whatever, said he took another pill at some point in time, and was awoken by a law enforcement official on the 8th in a hotel room, and he was then placed in the hospital in Spotsylvania, spent about 8 days there. While there was, and there's medical records that states that it was a possible overdose, that it was due to a mix-up of medication, they screened him for narcotics. I did not see a screening for whatever medications that he had either been taken or had been prescribed then or in the past. And so the trial court seemed to think that he was either making it up because we had a pendente lite hearing in February in which I convinced the court to allow visitation. I was cut off, however, in the motion to reopen when I was trying to discuss how mental health is not static, because trial court made it very clear that while he represented in February that he was perfectly good to go and I awarded visitation. Now your testimony is incredible because you're saying he's not okay now. And what I was trying to explain to the court, that mental health goes up and down. The fact that he had been in and out of the psych ward and in and out and having his medication changed on numerous occasions, which he testified to.
Let me go back for a minute, if I may, to the question of the imputation of income. Now, the court heard some evidence, not from your client, but from the opposing party about the client's previous employment. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And is it your contention that that evidence was insufficient to allow the court to impute income, or that the errors of the court did not prepare guidelines?
Well, both, Your Honor. The testimony, not only from Mrs. Garrett, but also Tim Mullins, I think his name was, he testified that his contract ran out. There was some discussion where plaintiff tried to get in some hearsay testimony, and I objected, and the trial judge basically carved out a new exception to the hearsay rule. It's the government said it, which means it's an exception, and it's not hearsay rule. Which I objected to, and so he had testified that he wasn't eligible for rehire. And again, over objection, he said, due to poor performance over the past couple of months and some absences. One absence one could presume was the one where he was in the hospital when the contract ran out, and they were looking to restaff the contract for further people. And again, that happened after the February pendente lite hearing in which visitation was awarded and the June hearing which he was absent for. And so by the court allowing that incredible evidence and also plaintiff's counsel stated that she wasn't offering it for the truth of the matter asserted. So it failed both because it was hearsay that was objected to and because counsel said it was not being offered for the truth of the matter. Therefore, it's not evidence that the court could rely on, make a decision as far as his employment or lack thereof.
Setting aside the hearsay issue with regard to the second witness, could the court have relied on the testimony of what?
by saying that he was not employed, and I think that's all she was able to testify to as far as his employment. She did not testify to much interaction with his employer other than to inquire, where is he? She was worried about his whereabouts because he did not show up for visitation.
But she also testified about his annual salary and income, is that right?
Yes, I believe so, yes. It was 109. And that was the one-year contract that he had for the 109 that expired May 31st, 2016. Okay. And at the motion to reopen evidence, it was clear by Mr. Garrett's testimony that he had been experiencing fluctuations in the medication that was having an impact on him and his ability to function. And that's clear because not only June of 2015, the end of May, early June 2016, but also, there was another time before that, and there was another time since then, but in essence, two or three lengthy stays. I believe there was 2 10-days and 1 8-day stay. Yes, there was. The Spotsylvania Hospital and 2 stays in the VA. Certainly gives credence to the fact that he was having issues, that he might not be employable, that Mr. Gibbons said he was ineligible to be hired. He wasn't competent to testify as to why, and unless you go with the government exception to hearsay, that it was due to poor performance, which again doesn't mean voluntary or absences. The absence.
The struggle, though, and I appreciate your advocacy, counsel. Excuse me, counsel. You've done a very good job for your client. But the problem is, in this case, you seem to suggest that there are all kinds of circumstances that should have affected the trial court's determination. But isn't the root of the problem the fact that your client wasn't there to support the very good argument that you're making here today?
Right, and again, that's two things. One, that plaintiff didn't establish evidence that my client's lack of employment was voluntary. And then two, he was not at trial, not because he chose not to be there, not due to misconduct, but due to the circumstances surrounding his medical conditions, which was presented at the August 5th motion to reopen, in which the court should have then reopened the evidence and should have first considered and given due credence to the evidence presented that that was why he wasn't there at trial, and then open the evidence to have him testify to all of the equitable distribution matters, grounds of divorce, and all those things that were completely one-sided due to his absence at trial. Again, imputing income is the exception, not the rule. That's the Murphy case. The court does not have to, can, but must follow those specific steps in order to do that. That is, run the guidelines using actual current income and then lay out factors why there is a deviation. That deviation, again, being established by competent evidence put on by the proponent of the imputation of income, which simply didn't happen. I see that my time is up.
Let me ask you one other question. I'll give you a little bit of extra time. Is there, and counsel, I'm asking both of you, is there any disagreement with regard to the nature of the divorce that should have been in this case?
Well, Your Honor, yes, and that's...
Okay, that's all you need to say. All right, very good.
Tara Steiner, and I am the counsel for Ms. Andrea Garrett in this matter.
Counsel, as you get rolling in this case, let me ask you a question. One of the things that jumped out at me as troubling is the determination to award more than 50% of the marital share of the military benefit. What is your authority for that?
I apologize, Your Honor. I believe in my brief of the appellee here that I did not ask for more than 50%. If I did, that was the
trial court awarded.
Correct, and as I addressed it in my brief, Your Honor, I believe that it was just a clerical error on the part of the, there was no testimony asking for the entire marital share.
You agree that at least for that, it should be remanded for that purpose.
Yes, Your Honor, as I addressed in my brief, I do agree with that.
Along the same lines, the non-modified spousal support?
Yes, Your Honor, and I addressed that in my brief as well, where I did agree that that should be remanded because the words non-modifiable should absolutely be taken out of that. You'll also find in the brief, I also did state that I agree with the GI Bill issue as well. As I researched it, The judge did grant us the GI Bill. However, federal preemption is not going to allow that. So my argument was is that because they did not properly plead that, that it shouldn't be an issue before the court. However, the practical matter of it is that it's not going to be divided. The federal jurisdiction is not going to allow that to take place.
Yes.
So I've asked.
So we want orders that are consistent with what the feds require us to do.
Absolutely, Your Honor. So I am asking.
80% down the road, so let's go down the rest of the way.
Okay. A lot of this is I am relying on my brief to say that you can see that from my argument, but if it pleases the court, I'd just like to address a couple of the arguments that Mr. Williams addressed. Regarding the imputation of income, he said that Mr. Williams' interpretation of how this testimony went down is that it's that he wasn't eligible for rehearing just because maybe he didn't show up a couple of times or because he was in the mental health facility and therefore they should feel pity on him and or honor that that's where he was and there was a medical excuse. The problem is that Mr. Garrett didn't contact anybody to say where he was. He was out of the office for 10 days and he contacted no one. He did not have his fiance contact anyone. So it's not a matter of that there's discrimination because he was having a mental health issue.
He was actually admitted to the hospital the day after the hearing, is that correct?
On the 8th, yes, ma'am. The hearing was scheduled for the 7th. He was admitted to the hospital the afternoon of the 8th. So there's still no known circumstances to what his whereabouts were on the actual day of trial. The judge, by the way, one of the reasons that I believe firmly that the judge didn't abuse her discretion is because over and over again, she gave Mr. Williams an opportunity to find Mr. Garrett and to find his fiance. His fiance was also subpoenaed to show up for court, and he had also tried to contact her multiple times and was unable to reach both of them. So even if it is understood that one of them took a wrong pill, and then he states that the wrong pill he took was an Ambien, that means that roughly he was asleep for over 40 hours, which could very well have happened. It just doesn't seem very plausible in this case because then the question is, did his fiance also take an Ambien and was she also asleep for 40 hours? Because the judge gave us wide discretion to try to find Mr. Garrett and to try to find the fiance, to find anybody to know where he was. We had no idea where he was, and then the only proof that he showed up anywhere was to the hospital on the afternoon of June the 8th. So the question becomes, and what the judge had to determine, which I pointed out in the transcript, is she had to say, is there any good cause here for granting a continuance, which she tried to give Mr. Williams the opportunity to do over and over again, not only the morning, but then at lunchtime and during our breaks. Every time she would stop and say, have you found your client? Do you have any information? And every time he would say, no, I have no information. I have been unable to get in touch with my client and his fiance, who he shared a residence with. So my opinion is that it isn't an abuse of discretion when the judge over and over again gives these opportunities in order to try to find the client and give him the opportunity to present his case.
What's your position on the imputation of income with regard to support?
My opinion there is that it's to the discretion of the court to determine from evidence whether he was voluntarily underemployed. And we did present information on that. It was difficult to do the case without Mr. Garrett there because there were many things that we needed Mr. Garrett there to prove. But however, with the case that we had and with the limited amount of income information we did have his supervisor from work testify. And a supervisor from work testified what his salary was, stated he was ineligible for rehire, and stated that the reason he was ineligible for rehire was because of the at-fault decisions that he had made in his job, poor work performance, failure to call in, failure to do these things. So Mr. Williams portrayed...
Does that necessarily, bad work performance, does that necessarily note voluntary unemployment?
I would say in the particular employment situation of Mr. Garrett, it does. When it is a kind of business where, like as a defense contractor, where you're hired on a contract over and over again, where you're not a continuous employee, but essentially you are employed as the company gets a contract. There were positions available. However, they chose not to renew Mr. Garrett's contract to continue working for this contracting company due to his poor work performance. So his contract did run out while...
Your opponent colleague would suggest that the poor work performance was or could have been related to the fact that he was suffering from some disabilities, which then contributed to his poor work performance, which then thus made him not voluntarily underemployed or unemployed.
Yes, Your Honor, and that was the argument that he made in the trial court as well. However, the witness, Mr. Mullins, also pointed out some other factors that had nothing to do with the mental health issues, and the court heard those issues and then, as I assume, made the determination based on the other testimony, not just Mr. Williams' view of the testimony.
Counsel, I appreciate your candor, but isn't this case sort of a house of cards? Since we're going to have to remand for three or four different issues anyway, isn't there going to necessarily be the need to have a recalculation of income?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, since it is going to be remanded, I do have no issue with that. That is true. Okay. I was just addressing the appeal issue.
And so when we send it back for a recalculation, obviously, Mr. Garrett will be able to put on evidence through his client. I mean, Mr. Williams will be able to put on evidence through his client of actual income, assuming Mr. Garrett comes to court.
Yes, Your Honor. As I say that, yes.
Okay.
Also regarding, if I may just briefly address again, the abuse of discretion issue with the judge is, I think it's important to note, and I believe the judge made that clear in the transcript of her proceedings, is the reason that there was the comment on mental health. She was not flippant on the mental health argument as to why he missed it all. The issue is that when we were in front of the court in March of 2016, Mr. Williams and Mr. Garrett were adamant that his mental health records and his mental health history should have very little to do with the custody and visitation portions of the children, because they made it clear this was something in the past, and that to bring it up, we were exploiting it as a way to get custody and visitation of the children. So it was a very charged argument to say, how dare we bring up the mental health issue. The judge seemed frustrated that they use the mental health issue as a sword or a shield whenever it benefits them, is that they were adamant in the custody and visitation, how dare we even bring up his mental health issues because it's disparaging this man's name. However, when he had a mental health episode as a result of missing his own trial, then we needed to show great sympathy and care for that. And the judge pointed that out. When we had the motion to reopen the evidence, she gave Mr. Garrett an opportunity.
I'm a pragmatic person by nature. And again, getting back to the question that I had asked originally, and I appreciate your answer, where we would have to send it back on the GI Bill issue, we have to send it back on the non-modifiable support, we have to send it back on the nature of the divorce, and we have to send it back on the 50% of the military, getting more than 50% of the military share. Aren't we essentially arguing about something that is obviously now not right because we have to send everything back? Would we be, in essence, issuing an advisory opinion if we decided something where we know we're going to be able to have to send the case back anyway?
What I would be asking the court is to remand on the specific issues. The way I see it is that Mr. Williams is advocating that the case should be remanded to essentially be retried in its entirety to give Mr. Garrett the opportunity to present evidence he wasn't. I do believe that some issues should be remanded and those I addressed in my reply brief. However, I'm asking the court to limit it to just those issues and not reopen it again as a field day to allow Mr. Garrett to come and give testimony on the day.
What would he not be able to present on the remand that we're talking about that he would be able to present if we did it your way?
Oh, I'm sorry if I'm confused. I'm just saying to narrow down to those issues is that, as I understand, Mr. Williams is arguing that it was an abuse of discretion for the judge to not reopen all of the evidence, meaning like the payment of the couple's savings account, meaning the distribution of the house and the proceeds there. As I understand, he wants to open up the entire divorce again and equitable distribution open to argument. And my argument is we had a trial date for that, and that was June 7th.
Certainly any issues with regard to support would be reopened.
Yes, ma'am.
Absolutely,
Your Honor. And in fact, that is something that I am addressing, is that because Mr. Williams, I do believe that his analysis was correct on the GI Bill and that that isn't allowed. The point is, it seems, and the judge gave the GI Bill to Ms. Garrett in hopes that that would pay for some of her education. And so now that that is not going to be an issue for her, I do believe support needs to come back on this table for the judge to say, do I need to give more support because she's not getting the GI Bill?
And the military pension was awarded as part of the equitable distribution.
Yes, Your Honor.
So that could be reopened.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And just briefly regarding the abuse of discretion, Mr. Williams saying that Mr. Garrett was in the hospital, I'd like to point out to the court again is that that was on June the 8th. There was still no explanation of where he was on June 7th. And then they said that in the medical records that that they only tested for narcotics. This court has the medical records, as do I. It seems like they tested for every possible thing under the sun. There's no limitation that was only tested for narcotics or no limitation for anything. They did a full tox screen on him for every possible thing that was in his system, and it came back completely negative. This was a big issue to the trial court judge to say, if this was a mental health issue and your claim is that you took a pill that you shouldn't have took and that's what made you unable to attend trial, shouldn't your tox screen have shown something in your system, anything? So I wanted to point out to the court that I don't know where it is that they only tested for narcotics, but that certainly isn't in the record and it isn't in the exhibits that the court has. It seems to be that they seem pretty clear on their face that they did test for everything, and even the hospital was able to find no valid reason as to why he would have been able to participate in a court hearing. I reserve the rest of my time if you have any more questions. I may only
answer.
Thank you.
On page 742 of the joint appendix, it starts setting forth the medical records, and on page 743, it lists the items that were tested for, that is opiates, barbiturates, fenciclidine, amphetamine, benzoate, cocaine, marijuana, etc. So yes, the records are in the joint appendix, and I think it's pretty clear. Now, as far as the fog of the seventh, and there not being an actual line by line, time by time recitation of where he was, it's because, as he expressed during the motion to reopen, the medication made him loopy. He does not know where he was.
But counsel, as I understand it, looking at the assignments of error. We look at Simon of Error 3, trial court error, but it made an award of non-modifiable support in direct contravention of Code Section 20-109. Ms. Steiner, being the consummate professional, has conceded that that was error by the trial court. Number 4, the trial court error in awarding the entire federal share of military attention to appellant direct contravention of Code Section 20-107.3. Again, Ms. Steiner has suggested to the court that, or conceded that that was error on the part of the court. She's also recognized that because of those errors, there's going to be a need to recalculate a lot of things, including client income, what we're going to do with $68,000, how we're going to reassess what the support obligation should be, et cetera. It's going to essentially allow you the opportunity to present evidence, assuming your client shows up, of all the issues that you're raising here today. Why doesn't this satisfy what we need to do here to get the case in a proper form?
Your Honor, respectfully to the trial court, I think the trial court needs to be put on notice that there was an abuse of discretion here in the flippant treatment of his mental health.
Judge Willis is a good, solid judge. I don't think she would flippantly do anything.
Yes, Your Honor. However, when you combine the ambient, the depression, the PTSD that's on the evidence, that more, and you know, the transcript said that the hearing was held on the 8th. So, I mean, there's a little bit, and that's not true. It's held on the 7th. So there's errors not only in the transcript and the timing set forth around. But, okay, to get back to your question, I apologize. I think it's pretty clear that the court should address the issue of voluntariness of unemployment and the lack of evidence supporting that. And how the burden would be on the plaintiff to establish that, and that there is no government exception to hearsay.
Yes, sir. Thank you. We'll come down and read counsel.